Welcome to The Insider, the members-only podcast featuring War on the Rocks authors. This show will explore, in depth, a featured article every week and why it matters for national security. My name is Nick Danforth, editor and host of the show. Let's dive in. We're here today with Alex Harstrick, and we're talking about his article, How America Lost Its Global Connectivity Lead and Why the Future Depends on Getting It Back. Alex is a managing partner and co-founder of J2 Ventures, a fund that specializes in early-stage companies that are looking to partner with the U.S. government. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
So, first question, we're going to talk about why and how America lost its global connectivity. But to set that up, what are the risks? What challenges are we facing because we have lost our global connectivity now?
So, it's a great question. It's kind of what inspired me to write the article in the first place. And as you guys know, in editing it, it went through a lot of iterations of a really creative way to lead into something cute that would capture the audience's attention. And what it comes down to is if you peel back any critical aspect of military projection of power, all of that comes down to coordinating a lot of things to do a lot of things simultaneously. In any human organization, the reason it's so hard to get things done at your job, or if anyone served in the military, you know that orders need to go down a chain of command is at its base element, how people talk to each other. And the reason humanity is able to operate at a global scale is because we have global connectivity. And I think America has underappreciated the extent to which we have controlled the mechanisms for that global connectivity. And it's not lost on our near-peer adversaries how important that is if they are to subvert what we want to have happen and insert what they want to have happen. And so if you peel back kind of any time that America has had some kind of action against another country, or a country has had another action against the United States, or any sort of conflict, it all comes down to how can I coordinate the mass amount of information, the most amount of information, to the most amount of people as efficiently as possible. And whoever controls that mechanism the best is usually the side that wins. And so if we look at what the threats are globally and the people we're worried about globally, I think we should be worried about this.
So talk us through, you mentioned the example of Taiwan that you kick off the piece with, and it's a very vivid example. And I think people can viscerally understand you've got an island there, there are specific cables connecting that island's communication infrastructure to the rest of the world. You cut those cables, as it sounds like Chinese fishing boats accidentally have, you lose connectivity. What does the risk look like for a country like America? What does the risk look like when you're the American military looking to project force abroad? What are the cables? Where are the nodes? What are the other kinds of things that an adversary would target in some kind of hypothetical conflict?
Outside of the risk of losing a very, very critical country in production of chips for the United States, right? I think everybody knows that story is told. That's why we care. That's why we're talking about this issue. I'd say the bigger risk is that war will fundamentally change and America will be caught flat-footed, not even realizing how the tactics have changed, and we'll lose a lot of global standing as a result. And it will be humiliating for us and we'll have to catch up in a way that we can understand how war has changed. It's kind of like you may be the best guy with a broadsword. If you don't know that the other guy's bringing a bow and arrow, it doesn't really matter. And I think we're being caught in this aspect of we think because they're near peer adversaries, they fight like near-peer adversaries do. They don't have to. They have to fight to win. That's all that they care about.
And you suggest in the piece that, in fact, our adversaries or our future adversaries have given a lot of thought to how they would target American connectivity in the course of a conflict.
There's no question. It has to haunt them every single night. These are the things that they care about more than anything else. America cares about a lot of things. We have interests everywhere. But our adversaries, which I don't think even we need to tiptoe around the fact of calling them near-peer competitors, they're pretty adversarial. All they think about is conquering these two countries, which right now are Taiwan and Ukraine, respectively. Whether they have broader ambitions, maybe they do. I'm sure they do. And you look at the case of Africa and the case of China. But the thing to appreciate is there's nothing they think about more than this. And so they will have thought through every method by which they can achieve their ends. And it, for us, is just one of many things we're thinking about.
And so then in, let's say, a hypothetical conflict with China over Taiwan, I mean, again, I get that where Taiwanese connectivity could be targeted in a very tangible way by China, but I assume that wouldn't be the extent of their efforts. I assume that other, you know, aspects of America's global communications network that would enable the United States to get forces to the Indo-Pacific, that those would also be, and communicate with those forces, that those would also be potential targets.
Absolutely. If I were to spell it out, Nick, right, the way that this goes down and what I wrote in the article was, let's say a ship anchor just very innocently as the thing that cuts off power. It doesn't make any news articles. Nobody cares. Ship anchors tear down the power all the time. As we discuss in the article, this ABC report that basically said that there was an anomalously large amount of tears that were happening outside of Taiwan as compared to other places where there are all of the exact same conditions met. So America doesn't see the headline. 5 days go by, there's some kind of issue in repairing it because it's Huawei that's actually in charge of repairing the technology. And in the meantime, China is able to put a very strategic blockade around Taiwan and basically threaten people into submission. By this point, even if it is not the only thing that they tear down, they are five chess moves ahead of us when we don't even realize the game has begun. And then when we think about the case of what redundancy we do have, that does require quite a bit of coordination using these existing layers to make sure that we can put the redundant information in the first place. So when you look at Ukraine, so the first thing that the Russians did was, you know, shoot down the internet. So we thought that we had a panacea. It was Starlink, and that's great. And there are people who love Elon Musk and there are people who hate him. I would say if you look at it in the case of each individual condition, when would you ever want the future of your country in the hands of one single individual that is a private sector individual, profit focused, that has really no ties to whether you are free or enslaved and is functionally subsidized by a government that could actually just step in and put the technology in themselves? And we've had this kind of hands-off approach that I would encourage us to stop in the future.
Well, and before we get into that, I did want to ask, because it too was interesting with both the Starlink example and the Taiwan example you gave, it does seem like there are two sides to this. One, there's the physical infrastructure. There's the threat to, you know, a cable, a satellite that can be destroyed regardless of who owns it. And then there's another set of concerns with Starlink where it very much has to do with who the owner of the company that's providing a service is. And it's a corporate decision rather than, you know, a physical or a military attack on infrastructure.
Yeah. What I would say is it's very difficult to encapsulate the entire industry in 2,000 words. But if we're observing it, I wanted to say what we have right now is at risk and the solutions we have are inadequate. Because outside of who the owner is of Starlink, you're always going to have this issue. Who's the military going to partner with? Do we want a bureaucrat running this? Is that going to be a better solution? I don't think so. It's more about diversity and redundancy and then owning the mechanisms in some way that the DoD can consistently enforce should we have an issue in the future. And that's all that I wanted to explain. What we have now is insufficient. The way that we're moving is equally insufficient. There are two issues with Starlink in particular outside of its capricious owner. The technology is actually non-coherent light, which beams down, which is really nice if you're in a rural environment, but it actually degrades by each individual user. Maybe Starlink can figure this out in the future, but it's important to note that when you look at all these really exciting deployments, they're usually happening in rural areas where there's very little competition for spectrum. So I don't think that we have fully appreciated that Starlink is so far an extremely successful measure in what they are trying to do. But as time goes on, it will not get us the bandwidth speeds that we have become used to that will not become competitive. If I were China, I would similarly exploit this from just a physical point of view of being able to put a bunch of nodes and absorb the spectrum and deny spectrum then to other people who need it. And I would be more tolerant of that as an alternative if I didn't know that the DoD was incubating really exciting technology now that they should be taking a much more forward position in deploying.
And that gets to the heart of your piece. What are the steps that you're recommending to address this?
There are three mechanisms that help us get to a much better position in communicating with each other. And I would say that you can think about them on a spectrum themselves of really easy to implement and then really, really fun to implement that are going to be 0 to 1 in the future. And I understand like the audience will have a varying degree of understanding or caring about how it is that these all happen. But if you think about the way that we connect with each other is basically being a series of pipes. And those pipes are visible in the case of actual cables and invisible in the case of how your Wi-Fi connection or your cell phone connects to something. All of that is going off of let's call it a traffic cop. And the traffic cop is basically something that we have to replace every single time that we create some kind of new type of spectrum. So if you think about GSM to CDMA, which people who have had those Nokia phones, you'll see at the top, it'll say something, you know, back in the day of the type of connection that you were having, and then the type of bars that you have as associated with that. That is the GSM versus CDMA versus 5G, 3G, 4G, whatever. And then the strength that you have within that connection, that all requires, let's just call it like a different type of traffic cop. The traffic cop does a bunch of things. It makes sure your phone, Nick, belongs to Nick and nobody else. Make sure Alex's phone, who's right next to Nick's phone, is going to be different. And then associates power and transmission to those two devices. we can do a much better job of optimizing that with purely digital infrastructure. And there's a lot of companies that do that. The DoD is pretty behind on a lot of this. So the next iteration of that that I talk about in the piece is private 5G. So when you think about when you're at a hospital system, for example, everything is going to be connected by Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi has a bunch of issues with it. It's really easy to intercept. In fact, you can go on Amazon right now and buy a Wi-Fi pineapple. I can set up a fake I'm on the War on the Rocks Wi-Fi channel. Everybody connects to that. Now I have all your passwords. This is catastrophic if you're at a hospital system or any other kind of sensitive system like a military installation. If I take that traffic cop and I turn it into RoboCop, that's a private network. That is an installation that's kind of next level of how I'm going to both optimize and make sure that my enemy cannot get in the way of sub-optimizing this. And then the last is literal lasers that are called free space optics using coherent light. That's like a very, very sharp laser. And imagine if instead of laying cable, I shoot a laser beam that cannot be intercepted because it's moving so fast. I have very little degradation as compared to a fiber optic cable. But now I don't have anything you can cut. Like we're now higher speed than anything we've ever seen before with no ability to be denied.
And I think this is rapidly going to go beyond where I at least can follow the actual science of this. But what when you're talking about this kind of laser communication, I mean, the basic understanding, again, at least I have of lasers, I mean, you can block them relatively easily. What makes these different?
So it's a good point, right? I mean, now you have this technology you can just sort of put a mirror in front of. Here is where you get into a lot of technologies that will make like a software-defined network or optimization in the layers around them. The beauty of it, Nick, is if the laser is being blocked, at least I know it's being blocked and it's not being intercepted, as opposed to if I have a cable that I literally do a wiretap on where the term comes from, I have no idea in modern times. The other part is the lasers themselves are not going to be non-redundant. Right? It's all about the routing by which I do it. And so if I want to block the laser, I'm going to shoot it up into space and then space is going to shoot it down, or I'll shoot it up to the nice thing about coherent light is you can do ground to ground, ground to space, ground to air. Yes, you might be able to block ground to ground. It's really hard to block ground to space without actually being at the terminal itself, at which point you've had an adversary permeate your physical infrastructure. You have bigger issues than that, right? The Chinese have invaded the United States. That's a problem. And it's that redundancy and the ability to install that redundancy really quickly on demand that lasers can do that fiber optic cable cannot.
So then setting aside the technical aspect of this, or not necessarily setting it aside, but what on the Pentagon side, on the bureaucratic side, on the financing and funding and preparing for this side, what kinds of steps should people in Washington be taking right now to give the United States access to all of this technology? I mean, ideally, as soon as possible.
The problem is, Nick, and I see this as an investor, and you know, I made my bias very clear in the article. My job is to invest in these technologies. I'm really excited by it. This is how I make money. The beauty of what I do is that I can de-risk short-term product market fit with these companies because the Department of Defense is willing to pay for the R&D that goes into building next generation infrastructure. And the example I give in the article of Fairchild Semiconductor is the first and best example in VC history. I argue the entire reason venture capital exists is because the Pentagon gave non-dilutive funding to Fairchild Semiconductor, which were a bunch of guys that came out of Bell Labs that said, I know how to melt sand to communicate with other people by melting sand. When you think about it in the context of that argument, the laser thing doesn't sound so crazy. And if the government hadn't have given them a lot of money to do it, we wouldn't have the infrastructure we have now. You and I would not be talking by computer now. And what I worry about is when you look at the defense budget of $800 billion plus, there's actually very little that is going into this kind of infrastructure. We're a lot more excited by the things that we feel are right in front of our face. And the big conversation I'm seeing right now is drones, counter drones. Drones can't talk to each other if you don't have the infrastructure by which they can talk to each other. And they can be weaponized against you if that infrastructure can be weaponized against you. We're answering the wrong question. I think the conversation needs to be more around infrastructure and the amount of spend that we have on all of these different types of companies that are dependent on infrastructure, we need to focus on more. Because the Department of Defense, by virtue of the POM cycle, actually should be thinking 3 years in advance, right? Just how, and I assume the readers are knowledgeable enough on acquisitions to kind of understand what I'm saying, but they have to make decisions years in advance. So the DoD, if they're thinking about the problems we're having now, is already 3 years too late.
So part of this is just about prioritizing connectivity in funding decisions that are being made right now.
We're spending like $250 million of an $800 billion budget to figure out this question on the private 5G aspect alone. all the other pieces are things that you're going to have to subordinate under JADC2 and make an argument about why it fits that item. And I just wanted to call it out. We can't talk to each other. That's a big problem. Let's put money behind it.
And on that note, what kind of feedback have you gotten on your article? I think it's been a couple of days since it came out now.
So far, it's positive. But I'm not so foolish as to think that just because people are being nice to me, that other people are maybe not disagreeing with it. I think the most important disagreement somebody can make is if you were to peel back the global telecom providers now, most of them are American. And so you'd say, what's the problem, right? The largest market cap. In fact, I thought about making this argument in the article of some seeding market cap of these companies, but the evidence would not say that, right? You still have Verizon, and among the of the 10, actually five of them are American, that are doing just incredible numbers. The issue is, the easiest way I would fool the United States if I were not from here is I would say, you're really profitable, you're making a lot of money, there's nothing to see here. And that's the easiest way to fool us into thinking that we're on the right path. But the innovator's dilemma is that we actually have to fundamentally disrupt ourselves if we are going to maintain that path 10 years in the future. And our adversaries can make long-term decisions like that. And if we don't pull ourselves out of this profit cycle, then we are going to miss the boat on the next generation of this stuff.
Any final thoughts?
I appreciated your guys' editorial process. I think we did 8 reviews back and forth. So I think the end article was well beaten up in a way that I feel actually much more confident. And I appreciate War on the Rocks for giving us the platform to do that.
That's good to hear. Yeah, as appreciate all our authors. We appreciate the ones who are patient with our editorial process. And also appreciate you coming on to talk about the piece.
Thanks very much, Nick. I appreciate it.